I'm Jessica Marquardt, and welcome to Kaleidoscope, the Cortical Visual Impairment Podcast. Cortical visual impairment, or CVI, is a brain-based visual impairment. People with CVI can see, but they have trouble sorting out or categorizing what they're seeing. In the developed world, including the U.S., about 30 to 40% of kids with visual impairments have CVI. It's the leading cause of pediatric visual impairments and has been since the 1990s. There are fundamental differences between a brain-based visual impairment and an ocular one. Amazingly, a person with CVI can improve his or her functional vision because of this important concept: neuroplasticity. It's an honor to host Alicia Waugh. Not only is she an orientation and mobility specialist and Perkins Roman CVI range endorsed professional, but she is mom to 10-year-old Griffin, who has CVI. Alicia's CVI knowledge is deep and wide, and if you aren't driving, you may want to pull out your notebook. She has successfully mastered the educational principles of CVI and has applied them to help Griffin move from phase one to phase three on the CVI range. Griffin now reads fluently and is inquisitive, and he loves playing with Legos and the Nintendo. With her business, Fundamentals First, Alicia guides other families nationwide on their quest to give their children visual access to the world. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Jessica. How are you?
I'm well, and I'm so glad you gave me any of your time, let alone on a Friday evening.
That's the only time I can find time.
What's your family doing right now?
Well, my husband's installing closets. One of them's playing a video game. One of them's, I don't know, making arts and crafts. And I don't know what the other one's doing. Hopefully staying out of trouble. So,
how is Griffin? What is he up to?
Well, he actually was trying to use GarageBand on my computer before I took it over. I told him to look up a YouTube tutorial video and figure out how to use it because I really don't know how to use it myself. He wants to make his own music somehow.
Cool.
So he takes adapted piano lessons.
Oh, okay. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So he can read music, actually. But, you know, he's not the most fluent at reading it, but he knows his notes pretty solidly. He's just not really quick at it.
Is that a standard program, adapted piano?
So we tried two traditional piano teachers, and that did not work. I tried to explain his disability and explain cortical visual impairment. Look, he's going to have trouble looking and using his hands at the same time. That's going to be an issue. So she didn't get that. So now we have somebody who has trained to work with kids with disabilities and special needs. And he used color tabs on the keys to help him learn each key. And he would use color highlighting on the notes as well on the music sheets. And he's been taking piano now for, I want to say, 2.5, 3 years. He's still at single notes and he still can't play both hands together, but he can play each hand individually. So that's good. So it's a slow progress, but, you know, he still is able to play and he seems to like it. So we keep at it.
Well, that's great. As long as he finds it fulfilling and enjoyable, it's a great activity. I mean, it's so good for the brain and building connections. Really, really cool. What else does he do?
Well, he was taking swimming lessons. We've tried to find sports that don't involve tracking a ball. A lot of other kids running around a field, the latency, it's hard to track a ball. The complexity of a lot of kids moving and just the sound, you know, kids yelling and that kind of thing. It's too much for him to visually process everything going on. Now he does like personal training for his athletics, so to speak. He gets worked with one-on-one. They adapt the exercises so he can do them. We take videos of the exercise and review them with him. And there's a lot of like verbal mediation or talking through the exercise. There's a lot of one-on-one demonstration that he can follow them. He seems to do better when they're doing the exercise with him side by side. You know, in the past, we tried soccer when he was younger and that just didn't work out too well. I've tried to get him involved with golf. We have a little putt-putt in our backyard, like a little green. And he hasn't been real interested in that. So, but I thought that would be a good sport because it's an individual sport. You know, there's a ball staying still when you go to hit it and the white ball against the green backdrop. I thought that would be good.
Well, it's hard enough giving each child enough opportunity to find something that they're interested and good at. But then you add CVI into the mix. It's kind of hard as a parent to figure out what's even possible. And then to find a coach or instructor who gets it and then can creatively adapt lessons for my child.
I agree. And what we've had to do is interview instructors beforehand and explain CVI and explain that his progress is going to be slower. You know, they're going to have to adapt how they present things. I've never had anybody say they knew what cortical visual impairment was to begin with. Usually they're interested. And then we trial out with him and see if he likes it. And he never loves anything, but if he doesn't complain about it, I figure it's a win. We also got him involved in like drama because I figured, you know, that's not so much movement and he is really good at memorizing things, memorizing words, lines. So he seems to like that the best, but definitely it's an interview process with the instructors and explaining CVI and explaining that progress is going to look different for him compared to a typical child. You see who's receptive and who isn't, but it definitely is a process. Nothing is easy and nothing comes naturally.
Well, I don't know Griffin, but I know a little bit about his backstory and we will get back to the beginning in a minute, but he's come a long way. He was born in 2008. He was born 4 months prematurely at 24 weeks gestation, weighing 1 pound, 10 ounces. And when he left the NICU, there was no mention by the doctors of CVI or any visual impairment to be concerned about besides retinopathy of prematurity. When did you learn he had CVI and did that term mean anything to you?
He left the NICU and the only thing they wanted to watch with his vision is to check for retinopathy of prematurity because he was still not quite supposed to be due when he returned home. He was born on January 8th, due on April, I think, 28th. And we brought him home on my birthday, so a nice birthday present. The retina was still being vascularized and vessels were growing, so they were just going to check every 4 to 6 weeks and make sure that the vessels continued to grow and grew in appropriately. And so we would go back to the hospital for the ophthalmology recheck, and they were just looking at the retina and the vessels. They weren't looking at any visual functioning or anything like that. I was a pediatric physical therapist, and I had worked on early intervention teams with occupational therapists who typically will screen for ocular motor skills, tracking, that kind of thing. I waited till he was adjusted to be whatever age all of these tracking skills, fixating skills began. And I waited, and they never happened. I called the ophthalmologist's office and explained that they weren't happening and he just wanted to take a wait and see attitude. Well, you know, he's a preemie. Let's wait till he's a year old. I didn't want to wait because I had seen plenty of preemies in my professional career and knew that if there wasn't that neurological involvement, they tended to, you know, get those normal visual responses. So my husband asked around and found a pediatric ophthalmologist up in Cleveland that we set an appointment with. And when we took him that first visit, he told us cortical visual impairment. And at that time, I had already got the local sight center involved to start working with him. And when I came back and told her the diagnosis, she said, "That's what I thought. I didn't want to tell you. I wanted you to get from the doctor," because she said, "I know you. You'll start Googling it and you'll, you know, find out all this information." And so I had heard of cortical blindness, the old terminology for cortical visual impairment. And I had seen kids with that. I don't know if I was in denial, but I thought, well, I don't know. Maybe he really doesn't have it. But I remember crying on the way home, because to me, it confirmed that he had a brain injury. I was very hopeful his first year of life. When you bring home a preemie, they say you need to wait and see. And there's not an MRI that's going to tell you for sure if a child has brain injury or not. Sometimes you can have brain injury and the MRI doesn't show anything. So I remember feeling very upset, but thinking there's neural plasticity from my training as a PT and that there's something that has to be able to be done.
Well, you had a lot of knowledge to build on. Once you heard the term cortical visual impairment and knew that that is what Griffin had, how did you educate yourself? What resources did you use to help you along your way?
Of course, I Googled. Like the developmental therapist had said, that's why I'm not going to tell you the term. But I found Dr. Christine Roman Lancey's book. Really, there were very few resources out there, because that was 2008 that he was diagnosed. 10 years ago. Her book was published in 2007, so it had been out maybe a year. But beyond that, there were some articles out there that I found online. There were definitely no websites exclusively for CVI. So you would find hit or miss articles. I found Dr. Roman's book, and that's where I began. And really, the best resource was her book for practical application of strategies and that kind of thing.
Did you have a CVI range done pretty soon after that?
I did the range based on reading the book, but at the time, nobody in my area was doing the range. And actually, I felt like I was already educating the other providers. Like I felt like when I talked about the CVI range, nobody knew what it was. So I was saying, hey, I have this book and it has this assessment in it. He was a little under one at the time. And a couple years later, I was looking in the back of the book and found Dr. Roman's professional information that she worked at West Penn Hospital. So I thought, I'll give it a try and call them up. And that's how I found her. She was the one that did the first range on him ever.
So what kind of visual behaviors did you see in him as an infant?
For one, he just really had a lot of difficulty fixating on anything. And he definitely, if you can't fixate and make eye to object fixation, he wasn't tracking anything. So he wasn't following anything with his eyes. And typically with typical infants, you can, you know, talk to them, you can make facial expressions, and they will respond with their face. There was no return reciprocal facial expressions when I would make faces at him. It seemed like he followed voices, like he would turn toward sound more than he would a visual. And we had his hearing screened as well. That's what they typically do with preemies. And he passed his screen, but they were doing like it's a ABR. It's to test, does he have any neurological hearing loss? And he didn't pass that. He didn't officially get released from audiology till he was 18 months old. So even that wasn't real reliable. The other thing is he didn't blink. I remember my husband saying after we got the diagnosis of CVI, do you ever notice he doesn't really blink? So that visual reflexes, they weren't present. He had almost a flat effect, like what other infants would typically brighten at with toys or people's faces. There was no brightening. The only way I could get the brightening response was to actually tactilely touch him on around his face. So those were some of the visual behaviors I saw early on. Oh, and the looking at lights, you know. It's interesting because I had a professional photographer come to our house when he was like a couple months old because I didn't want to take him out in public with all the germs and him being an extremely premature infant. And he brought his light in. And as soon as he brought his light in, Griffin looked up at the light and it was like he was awake. I was like, oh my gosh, he looks like a typical infant and he looks so awake and alert. And that was the first time I'd ever seen that normal look, so to speak. So reaction to light definitely was there, you know, looking at light streaming in through the shutters, that kind of thing. So that light definitely played a big part in his visual attention.
Right. Well, we've mentioned he's come a long way. And with all of your family's hard work and intention, he's come from phase one to phase three. And I think I've heard you say, correct me if I get this wrong, but I think I've heard you say, it takes duration, intensity, and frequency of CVI interventions that are appropriate to see that sort of progress with functional vision. So what did that look like for you? What did you do to make improvement? Did you make any changes to your environment? And what kind of interventions did you put in place?
Part of it was just like even adapting. I remember the playpen, trying to decrease clutter and only present a couple things at a time. Also quiet. So making sure when I was wanting him to visually attend or try to get fixation responses, making sure it was quiet. Also dimming the lights and using light up kind of thing. So I would turn the lights off and then I would use a light up toy. And that was the way I could get him to visually fixate on something. And I always would make sure too, like he was laying down so he wasn't having to work his balance, work his posture, that he was fully supported. Things like that I would do. And I would just make sure I was doing it multiple times a day, giving him opportunities to use his vision multiple times a day. The other thing was narrating things. So before I had access to a light box, it's kind of funny when I think of it now, I went to Joann Fabric and I bought a tracing light box and I would make transparent. I would buy like simple pictures, like from a disc or something back when, I mean, technology has changed a lot in the last 10 years.
That's right.
I would like, on a, you know, a disc when you put it in, you get like images, like I would get child images that were simple. Then I'd take that to Kinko's and I'd make them make transparencies of it, the tracing light box. And I would go in my bedroom, turn off the light, support him in sitting, and I would explain and narrate to him the salient features. Like I'd say, this is a banana. It has a curve. It's yellow. And I would do this stuff before I heard Dr. Roman talk about salient features. Yeah, I guess I was just hoping that, you know, I wasn't thinking I was helping him with visual processing at the time. I just thought I was building his cognitive understanding of things. But really, I was probably helping his visual processing without really knowing it. I would do all that stuff. And I really got a lot of that stuff from, you know, Dr. Roman's book and suggestions. And then once we saw her, we changed the way we, I can remember my husband saying, we're going to totally either do this 100% or we're not. With kids with CVI, oftentimes you have a lot of different eggs in different baskets. I'm not saying I put all my eggs in the CVI basket. What I am saying is I put a lot of time and energy in focusing on the CVI above all else. I remember my husband said, we're either going to do this 100% and address the vision or we're not. Because when you have a kid with so many needs, you can say, okay, we're going to address the sensory processing. We're going to address the, I don't know, motor development. We're going to address the vision, or we're going to, you know, you have to decide. And so I remember when he was three, we decided 100% it's going to be vision first and the rest of the stuff will kind of follow. And so she showed us the way that she recommended teaching reading, sight word recognition, you know, bubbling around the entire shape of the word, using salient feature language to describe the word's visual appearance, things like that. So we started doing that and we hit that hard and taught him how to read that way. So I guess what I'm saying is we made a lot of materials, we followed her suggestions, and we just tried to make sure that we were integrating it into daily life, at least, you know, Monday through Friday. So the salient feature language, though, is easy to do just as you go along living, but you may not have adapted material to support it like you would with sight words that we adapted, things like that.
Right. I spend a tremendous amount of time trying to put together early reader books for Grace. She's a rising first grader and learning sight words and is interested in stories. She's a budding reader, but none of the books, I mean, you can't even go to the library and find a book that is nicely presented for a child with CVI. And then the thing about the salient features language is I wish I had known to do that with her as an infant from early on, because now as a six-year-old, she kind of balks at that when I use that kind of language. You know, I'll hand her toothbrush and say, here's your toothbrush. It has a long handle and bristles. And she'll say, Mom, don't do those salient features on me.
She even knows the terminology for it.
Yeah.
Aww.
So Griffin's in a home-based program. What does that look like? What kind of curriculum do you use?
This will be his third complete year. So the school year is winding down. So he will have had 3 years of being a homeschool program, we call it, under his belt. The first year, I was his teacher primarily, and then we had related services come in. And I'm a physical therapist and an orientation and mobility specialist. So I also served as those related service providers as well. But we had a private OT and a private speech therapist who helped us. And together, we all teamed and would work together. We all were on board with the CVI supports. I basically took the standards for the state for that grade, which at the time would have been first grade, basically creating my own lesson plans, not using a specific curriculum, and making sure to incorporate CVI adaptations and strategies to teach the standard.
Well, what does that look like in first grade? What kind of lessons did you have, and how did the CVI accommodations play into trying to improve the functional vision as well as teach the curriculum?
So, for instance, with numbers, kindergarten, you want them to be able to rote count up to a certain number. But once you hit first grade, you want them to have numbers beyond that, you know, at least up to 100. You want them to be able to visually recognize them and identify them. And you want them to start doing operations with numbers, learning math computation, plus zeros, plus ones, your simple additions, and then move on to simple subtraction. You want skip counting because that builds a basis for future math skills as well. So I should start by saying in preschool, we were doing a lot of these things in a home program anyway, on top of him attending a private preschool program that we actually hired an aide to attend with him that I had trained in CVI to make private program more visually accessible to him. And then he also attended the school district's integrated preschool program. But we were doing home programming then too, and we had already adapted like the numbers, how you do the words, where you outline them and you talk about the salient features or shapes and that kind of thing. So we had done that all the way up until the number 30. But when he got to first grade, I thought I didn't really need to do that anymore because he was doing quite well with, you know, sight reading, words that we had done that with, and also the numbers. But I found out quickly that he wasn't really having a visual memory of those numbers in his mind. So we had to adapt the numbers. We adapted 30 through through 100. And then each day we would go over the visual of the numbers and what it looked like to help him form a strong visual memory of it to then be able to use the numbers. So if he couldn't have the visual memory of the number in his mind, he really couldn't do anything with that. For instance, we would make adaptive flashcards that had the outlining around each number, and then we would come up with verbiage oftentimes that he gave us that he thought it looked like, say, a duck or what have you. And we would write that down so that we would have that and could be consistent in our language when we described the visual image of that particular symbol. So that's just an example. When we did reading for reading comprehension, I would want to make sure that he's forming pictures in his head. So we would talk about what kind of picture he formed in his head. And there's a particular program out there. Linda Mood Bell makes it. I think it's visualization and verbalization. But we would try to work with him on making a picture in his head when he heard a certain word, and what does that picture look like? And then you're really talking about salient features. He would have to describe it to me, and then I would draw what he described, and then he would have to look at that and say, is that what you were thinking in your mind? So working on the visualization with reading, that was something we really focused a lot on. Occluding things, so when we show him pictures, occluding and looking at pictures, first the whole and then into parts with occlusion so that he is seeing the details of each part. It's just a lot of adaptation, and it's constant. And that's why I think our home program has really helped him, because it sounds like he's prompt dependent, but he's not. It's just that he needs so much adaptation to help him visually process.
You are brilliant. I mean, you know the CVI principles inside and out, and then you're able to extrapolate that to apply to all parts of his curriculum. I mean, I personally think that you should license your curriculum so that we all have access to it, but that's just me.
Yes, I keep saying if I have time to get it all down, accessible to other people, I definitely want to do that. I'm like, where does all this time go? I look at time flies and I'm like, oh, I have time.
Well, all your time is going to adapting things so that he can access his lessons visually and really the world visually. It's a lot.
Right. For instance, we were at a function this weekend at someone's home, and they had one of those porch swings that have a frame swings. I don't know what you want to call them. They're like the bench seats on the chains that you can hang from porches, or it can hang on a frame, like an A-frame. And he knows what swings are. We have a swing in our basement because we have a sensory integration swing. We have a swing set in our backyard. You know, we go to plenty of playgrounds that have swings. But he looked at that A-frame porch swing and he looked at me and he said, what is that? My other kids with typical visual processing can look at that and extrapolate that, okay, it's not touching the ground. It's on chains that connect to something higher. It's a swing where he needed the salient features. And when I explained the salient features and said, what do you think that could be? He knew. He then was able to say swing, but it wasn't an automatic thing. And so you see things like that a lot when you have a child with CVI that other people look at them and go, oh, well, they're so sighted and they, you know, can read so well, or they can do this or that, but they don't realize the amount of conscious effort it takes for that child to visually process everything in their world.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I was telling someone the other day that Grace really enjoys it when I read chapter books to her, like really lengthy ones. She's learning sight words. She has an affinity for math, but she can't recognize an illustration in a children's book. And they were floored. I mean, it's such an odd juxtaposition.
Yes, yes. And they compensate so well that people are actually thinking that they're recognizing them by their face when it's really a certain clothing item they wear all the time, or the way they wear their hair, that's what they're using.
Well, actually, can you tell the story about the time that one of Griffin's therapists changed her hair and he was confused? He thought maybe there was a stranger in the house?
Yes, and she had changed her hair color and cut her hair shorter, and he saw her like 3 days a week. So she was definitely a familiar person, but when the hairstyle changed, I asked her not to speak because I didn't want him to use voice recognition, which is another thing kids with CVI use to recognize people or identify people. And so she didn't speak. And I said, who do you think that is? And he could not tell me. And he was, you know, anxious about it. And I also find with new people, he struggles on looking toward them too. But usually if I can describe their salient features, then he's able to look more toward their face. So I use that as a strategy. But yeah, he was very concerned. He did not know who she was because she had changed her hair and we hadn't warned him that she was getting a hairstyle change.
I cut and dyed my hair on a whim and came home And Grace saw me and she cried and cried for hours. And then her younger sister fed off of that and she was crying. I felt so irresponsible because I know that Grace uses hairstyle as a cue for who's around her. And that really, really threw her off. She asked me once a week, when are you changing it back to brown? Until I did.
That's their familiar known. Well, and they'll do that with peers or friends too. I noticed when my older son brings around his friends, he will know it's, say, Ryan because Ryan's only here. But then if you get a few more friends that come over, he'll walk up and say, what is your name? And it will be Ryan, because it's like when you have multiple boys the same size, it's like, I don't know who you are now.
Since he's in a home-based program, what do you do for his social interactions?
Well, he is part of a homeschool co-op, which is basically groups of families who choose to homeschool, and they meet together in a church once a week. And they have actually classes where parents take the role of teacher for various classes. So he participates in that. So he gets to be around other kids his age there. And then we do a weekly play date with another friend that he's clicked with, so that he gets interaction there. And then because my other two kids are in public school and they have friends that they hang around, and we're friends with their families and they play well. But even then, it's hard. It's more parallel play than it is what we call cooperative play, where there's a common goal in mind and they're all working for that common end. It's more, I'm doing my thing, you're doing yours, and maybe we interact with the comment here or there. And a lot of it is peer teaching, that telling the friend, you know, you need to approach him in this way so that the experience is more visually accessible to Griffin. There's a bunch of kids and the kid comes up, it doesn't introduce, hey, it's so-and-so, then he may not know who that is. And with the complexity of running around a bunch of kids, a new game that he isn't real familiar with, he really can't participate in that. So a lot of times it requires more structure than what a typical child needs. You need the structure of a familiar activity, a familiar peer, oftentimes a familiar place, because there's so much to visually process if everything is novel. If it's a new game, they're having to process through a whole bunch of stuff and can't really interact with their other friends or the peers. So there's a lot of peer education that has to go on.
How do his siblings help him along?
So my younger daughter, she's a year and a half younger than him. She actually auditory mediates. She basically narrates a bunch to him, and she also tries to help him critically think, like, how do you know this is this? And she talks about salient features, and she uses comparative language. She has grown up with that already in place, so she naturally does it. And they are like best buds. They get along really well. My older son, you know, he's rough and tumble with him.
Typical brother behavior, I think. I know that my daughter also has a lot of empathy, but then there's the flip side of that. One child with cortical visual impairment takes so much more time, so many more resources. Do you ever think carefully about how to balance out your special time among three children when one has so many needs?
Yeah, I do. I need to do better. Like my oldest is very much involved in sports, and so he has practice pretty much year round for some sport that he's in. So my husband also helps with coaching. So he gets a lot of probably more time with my husband probably than he does with me. So I think he feels like he gets that special time, but I would like to give more of that special time. I just, you know, I'm stretched thin. So I do try to think of that too, and try to make sure that I'm spending time with each of them, but it is hard. It's difficult.
I'm really struggling with that. It's a constant checking in and balancing and making sure that each child has what they need.
Yeah, I agree. So I guess I'm not the best at that, but I try. And I think my kids, like you said, by having a sibling with special needs, they have that empathy and they understand that things are harder for that child with special needs. And so I've tried to explain that, you know, you don't need this additional help. He does. And so it's just the way that it is. I think that they acknowledge that, but I do think it's very difficult.
So let's shift gears a little bit. I want to hear about your process for becoming an orientation and mobility specialist and a Perkins Roman CVI range endorsed specialist.
Yeah, well, I became an ONM, and I don't want to say by accident, but it was intentional. It came about because I was already a physical therapist. We were looking for an orientation and mobility instructor for Griffin, and We thought we found one, and she ended up not having time to see him. I said to her, what am I going to do? Because everybody they would bring forth, one was getting ready to retire, the other one didn't have time. I mean, it was just one thing after another. And so I know in Ohio, I think there's maybe around 90 to 100 O&M specialists. But for the whole state, I mean, Ohio's a decent sized state. That's not very much. So we were having trouble. I said, well, what am I supposed to do? And she said, well, you already know so much about CVI. You're already a PT. Why don't you go back to school? And she actually sent me the link to apply to Ohio State's program.
That's perfect. How convenient.
And said, why don't you just go ahead and apply? So I did, and I got in. So that's kind of out of necessity. We needed an O&M. I needed to make sure that he was going to get O&M over his year. She said, you might as well just be his O&M and learn it, and then he'll always have an O&M. So, and then, you know, with having the background with CVI since the time Griffin was under a year old, I mean, I already knew about CVI way more than what I would ever have got in an O&M program. And, you know, it's an issue that the vision programs out there aren't really teaching a whole lot about CVI at all. So I already really knew what I needed to know about CVI at the time when I went to O&M school, and I just got the framework of what orientation and mobility is about in general. It just seemed like a natural thing to then apply for the endorsement. Living it, it was pretty, for me, it was a quick process to take the tests and that kind of thing and get endorsed.
For parents out there who haven't heard of the endorsement, can you explain what it means to get that designation?
So Perkins School for the Blind, in collaboration with Dr. Roman, has, first of all, they offer classes. So that way you can learn more about CVI and how to administer the CVI range and that kind of thing, and interventions and approaches to address CVI. So if you don't have that background, but if you do, you don't even have to take the classes. But what you can do is you apply to take the knowledge test. You take the knowledge test. And if you pass that, then you provide letters of recommendation from people who you've worked with, either their child who has CVI. It can also be a combination of other professionals who you've taught about CVI. You provide letters saying that, yes, I've had experience with this person. They seem to have a good knowledge of CVI, da 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 da. So you provide those letters. And then if that gets approved and passed on, then you take a test where you observe videos of children who have CVI in various phases, and the three phases of CVI. If you're not familiar with Dr. Roman's work, she designates three phases, phase 1, 2, and 3, and you score the CVI range using the video and information you obtain from that. And in the video, there are direct assessment things that you see Dr. Roman doing with the child. So you can, it's like you're giving the direct assessment. You can see what she's doing and see the response. You hear interview with the parents, and that's part of scoring the CVI range, and you're getting to observe the child too. So that's part of it. There's three components of scoring the CVI range. Then you get the endorsement, which basically says that you're able to accurately administer the CVI range, which is really just the beginning.
How many kids on your caseload have CVI?
Right now, I'm thinking, I know at least 2/3, but I think it's higher than that. And I'm thinking, like, my early intervention population, I see kids birth to 3 in the early intervention program. I also see school age kids. Yeah. So like right now, I think I have about 12 kids in EI, and 9 of the 12 have CVI. And then that's not my school age kids. So if that goes to tell you, I mean, right there, that's 75%.
That's staggering, but I guess based on the estimate of how many kids in the U.S. have CVI, sounds about right. So as a provider, what is the most important thing you try to impress upon the parents?
That really, it's about trying to build in visual opportunities within their routines of the day, not like something separate they have to do. And it's important the language they use, and that it's not really too early to start talking about salient features. That's going to help their child visually process what they're seeing. I think people struggle the most with the language piece of it. They struggle with giving salient features. They feel weird. I've heard people say, I feel weird, you know, saying this, because it just seems unnatural. You don't have to do that with other kids. They just notice those details. But with CVI, you have to give that additional information. That's hard for people. So nonetheless, the physical adaptations, maybe like decreasing the clutter, only providing one thing for them to look at a time, things like that, giving them wait time to look. But beyond those physical things is trying to describe what they're looking at. And also timing it. I mean, if they're in phase one, they can't listen to you and look at the same time. And they're not going to make really direct eye to object fixation anyway. You're going to see a glance towards something more out of the peripheral of their eye. But when you see that response, you want to quiet so that they can focus their energy on using their vision. And then when they look toward it, then you can confirm with the label, like with your voice, oh, you found the ball. But you don't want to keep talking when they're looking. So you want to time your talking with their looking. Things like that. But I would definitely talk to my child about what they're looking at. And that's one thing I don't think people naturally do.
Right. Gosh, I feel like we could do a whole other episode on your experience as a provider. You're just a wealth of knowledge. And I've just learned so much from you. I guess we could point people to your presentation on the Perkins website on orientation and mobility for students with cortical visual impairment. It can be found on Perkins eLearning website, which is perkinselearning.org. I attended when it was live. It was wonderful. So much information. I'm going to leave you with just one final question. Can Griffin describe what he's seeing through his from his own perspective now that he's 10 years old?
You know, I keep trying to get at that. You have to ask very specific questions. For him, his vision is normal. So he has no reference point to say, yeah, it's different than yours because X, Y, Z. But I do know with recognizing people, we have pinpointed if your sister's out there and there's a few other girls out there, how are you going to know which one's your sister? And he said it's the hair, that she has long brown hair. We said, well, if all of them had long brown hair, how would you know which is your sister? And he said, well, I'd look at their shoes. So I do know that he's using those less stable kind of things to recognize people. I've asked, do you really look at people's face to know, like in their face to know, and their facial features? And he said no. So I know he doesn't use facial feature recognition whatsoever. What else? Like with the swing example with the A-frame porch swing, I said, did you really not know what that was? I mean, again, it fascinated me because I thought we had done enough concept development around swingness that he would know automatically. And he said, no, I didn't.
Well, I lied. I have one more question. What does he want to be when he grows up? What are his hopes?
Well, lately it's a music producer. So that's funny. I was saying that he was on GarageBand. But he loves this band called Daft Punk. And they're like, they do like electronic music where they're making it with not actual instruments. And so he would like to be a music producer. I've heard him say teacher in the past. And what else? I've heard him say nurse in the past. So he's kind of, he has a few that he's thinking in his mind, but he loves like history. He loves like historical facts. So I see him doing something with that. So, but I do think with CDI that it's going to take us really looking at job responsibilities and trying to direct him down a path because, you know, I want him to be successful and I want him to do something he really loves to do. And with the visual processing issue, it's not like you can do everything, anything you want to. So I think that's going to be something that we're going to cross as he gets a little bit older. But that's what he wants to be, a record producer this year, is what he's saying.
Well, as the mother of a kindergartner, almost first grader, I'm totally unprepared to think about job preparation, but might make a nice topic for next time because there's this whole population of kids who are maybe slightly older than ours who are getting ready to graduate from the public school system or moving on. And the big question is, what's the next step and how do we help them?
Yes. There are some universities out there that have decent programs that help support kids with special needs, that they have, you know, accommodations and that kind of thing that, you know, I know Kent State has a decent one. I've heard Akron University around us, they have one too. So that's something I'm going to look into is college program that has more support than typical. The one thing with CVI is that as far as I can tell at this point, they don't go away. It's not like they fade off completely. So I think it's important that I find something as he gets older that's going to continue to provide a certain level of support.
Right. So the bottom line is children with CVI can continue to improve their functional vision, but CVI is always going to be there. It's part of who they are.
Yes. And that's something that I will have to say it from a parent perspective. I am coming to accept, you know, there's a grief process with having a child with special needs because you would like their life to be as easy as possible. I mean, that's what you want for your children as far as, you know, you want them to have to work. Yes. But you don't want things to be so challenging for them. And the grief process that the supports will continue to be need to be in place to help him be successful. You know, when he was younger, I kept thinking, well, we'll get to the point that we won't need these supports. And as he's getting older, I realized the supports will still need to be there. And so I'm working through that myself from a parent perspective. So yeah, I think that's important to keep in mind and know it is what it is.
Oh, so. It's so hard. But I have to say, it's done me a lot of good to listen to you about your journey and about Griffin. I mean, you have left no stone unturned, and people have so much to learn from you. It's just awesome. Thank you for agreeing to join me.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It was fun.
It was fun. The joy of producing this podcast is the opportunity to learn from other CVI families. Alicia left me inspired, and with some action items too. My biggest takeaway? Infuse rich narration into daily life. Describe everything by their salient features, and this will build Grace's visual processing. We've seen success with this, and I could always do more. It's sustaining to hear that our children's vision can improve. In Griffin's case, from phase one CVI to phase three, we have to maintain a growth mindset. Our kids are so worth it. You can learn more about Alicia and Griffin's journey and her business Fundamentals First at whattodoaboutcvi.com. Alicia and I believe that children with cortical visual impairment have a right to visual access and educational and social inclusion. I bet you do too. Join the movement. Find Start Seeing CVI Advocacy on Facebook. Thanks, y'all.